Thank you for helping us make Budget and for more than 5 million downloads of Issues Etc. in 2018. Thanks to your support, Lutheran Public Radio has been independent and in the black for almost 11 years. You've heard us say, now only our listeners can cancel us, and we mean it. Thanks for listening, thanks for your prayers, and thanks for your financial support of Issues Etc., live and on demand, and for our 24/7 talk and music stations. If you have been following the media coverage of the Roman Catholic priestly abuse scandal, one name probably sticks in your mind, Theodore McCarrick Cardinal, who, well, the nature of his crimes and his misdemeanors and his dalliances is only partially known, but what is known is absolutely shocking. His name is well known, but what about a name like John McCroskey? It's in the news. The nature of his indiscretions is somewhat different and of a smaller scale in terms of its sheer volume, but it's also a very big story. We're going to find out why as we talk about media coverage of the clergy sexual abuse in both Roman Catholic and non-Roman Catholic churches. Joining us to do so is Terry Mattingly, Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Glad to be here.
So why is it that this story about John McCloskey is getting as much press as it is?
Well, I think there's two or three angles to that, one of which is that John McCloskey may not be a name that regular news consumers might know, but he was extremely well known among reporters in the Acela zone between Washington and New York. This is a man who was a Wall Street professional in banking and finance who then entered the Catholic priesthood, and he became a very famous apologist for Roman Catholicism. I mean, and had numerous people who pointed to him as the reason for their conversion to Catholicism, including a senator or two, and then even a Supreme Court justice returning to the fold of Catholicism cited the influence of McCloskey. Justice Thomas is what I'm referring to there. McCloskey was extremely well known with the press. Second, we've had tons and tons of coverage of the clergy child abuse and abuse of teens. We've had a lot of coverage of that side of the Catholic scandal. Yet those of us who have followed this for a long time have believed that there's more to the sex abuse and clergy abuse problems in Catholicism than that, and think the overarching secrecy surrounding this is often linked to the fact that there are a lot of people, conservative as well as liberal, straight as well as gay, who have violated their vows. Well, here in the case of John McCloskey, you have a case of an extremely well-known, articulate, conservative Catholic who has admitted that he crossed boundary lines with women. Now, so far, we haven't had any evidence of sexual relationships. What we have is impropriety in terms of what has been called groping, you know, whether or not he touched women against their will. So I think to some degree, McCloskey's very well known with the press, and this is different than the child abuse things. This seems to fit the more of the Me Too, church to adult abuse case. The McCloskey case is certainly newsworthy. This was a very important figure in American Catholicism, and this deserves some coverage. I think it's interesting the degree to which when this woman, we don't know how often the woman, who is, by the way, is anonymous at this point, does not want her name to be known, but the Washington Post has interviewed her. She has had active contacts with Catholic leaders, and even in the very solid coverage at the Washington Post, she has, on the record, has said that she's still very active with Opus Dei, the organization, the conservative organization that John McCloskey was a part of, that she appreciates the recent actions of Opus Dei in making this public. Now, that kind of sounds to me like she had maybe asked them to do more in the past, or maybe she wasn't ready to go forward with her story until the whole Me Too, Church Too thing blew up this year. This happened, you know, well over a decade ago, this incident or incidents. We don't know if it's plural or whatever. So there's a lot here. The post stories have been quite good, in my opinion. But I think to some degree, the reason the post stories have been so strong is that the Opus Dei leaders have spoken so bluntly about what happened and have spoken so strongly about their remorse and saying that they would handle this incident different today than maybe they handled it a decade, decade and a half ago.
So you said that this looks more like Church Too, Me Too in the Church, kind of a Protestant variety of sexual abuse. Go into a little more detail.
Yeah, in my post, I stressed that because the question I hear from people all the time, it's something that we discussed a long time ago here in the podcast. Why do the Catholic stories always get so much coverage in comparison to the Protestant stories? In a post I put up today at Get Religion, I mentioned the fact that there are a lot of secular editors that basically Catholicism is the only religion that exists. It's photogenic, it's huge, it has big buildings downtown near the newspaper. Let's cover the Catholics. Years ago, when I was in Charlotte, this would have been the early 80s, and at that point, Catholicism in Charlotte, I think it was the smallest Catholic diocese in America. But the editors there were constantly asking me to write more about the Catholic Church. And I kept stressing, you know, we are in this very powerful evangelical and Protestant town. Billy Graham Boulevard, you know, is a major thoroughfare in this town. And Catholicism's really tiny. But all of their, these were not practicing Catholics or anything else, but all of their wiring was that you're supposed to cover Catholics as much as possible. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that. Catholicism is huge. It's very public. And it also has a clear structure of authority. And in a way, it's easier to cover Catholicism because it superficially looks more like a political system. It has parties, so to speak. It's easy to call up people. And there's this clear hierarchy. Whereas Protestantism, especially in its evangelical and charismatic forms, is so chaotic. You know, who are the leaders? How do you cover independent churches? How do you look for trends? We've talked about that before. What got to me about the McCluskey story is because of the fact that it is a heterosexual situation of abuse. It really resembled the cases of sexual abuse or sexual misconduct, is maybe a better word, in Protestant settings that I have covered for decades. In that almost all inappropriate sexual relationships that you will see in Protestant settings, a stunningly high percentage of them develop out of the practice of pastoral counseling, where you have ministers spending hours and hours in private meeting one-on-one with a lot of people. And because women are more likely to air their problems with someone else, and frankly, women are more active in most churches than men, we have had a very high percentage of male ministers involved in pastoral counseling with women. Now, that's exactly what we have here in the McCluskey case. We have a woman who is experiencing difficulties in her life and in her marriage. She goes to McCluskey at the Catholic Information Center on K Street in D.C. She goes to him for counseling. And out of that, the intimacy of those counseling sessions, he crosses a borderline into inappropriate touching or groping. Another woman complained that his hugs were suspicious or his hugs were improper. This looks more like what you hear about in a Protestant setting, quite frankly. Long ago, I had a chance to spend several days at the secret or the undisclosed location in Colorado of one of the most important counselors of ministers who ever worked, a Mayo Clinic level psychiatrist named Dr. Lewis McBurney, who set up a practice on the backside of the Rocky Mountains in Colorado, where ministers could say, hey, me and the wife are going off for a vacation in Colorado, when in reality they were going off to have help from this man to try to put their marriages back together. McBurney once told me, he said that about 99% of the cases he sees involved adultery or sexual infidelity of some kind. And he said the overwhelming majority of those started off with problems in counseling sessions. So that's why the McCluskey case looked to me more like a Protestant case, quite frankly, compared to all the rest of the sexual abuse cases we're seeing in Catholicism. There's a dynamite quote that I put in the column, the post today, from McBurney. I wrote this at the time he died a number of years ago. And here's the paragraph. Ministers may spend up to half their office hours counseling, which can be risky since most ministers are men and most active church members are women. If a woman bears her soul and her pastor responds by sharing his own personal pain, the result can be, quote, as destructive and decisive as reaching for a zipper, unquote, said McBurney. That puts the picture rather graphically.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about media coverage of the clergy sexual abuse scandal in Roman Catholic and non-Roman Catholic churches. When we come back, how did the media cover the organization Opus Dei itself?
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR9. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
How does Christianity compare with Islam, Mormonism, skepticism, Buddhism, Scientology, Jehovah's Witnesses, and other world religions? You'll find answers in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, The Christian Difference. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. Or learn more about The Christian Difference at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, The Christian Difference.
Solid, serious, substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Did you make a New Year's resolution to get in shape this year? You'll find quality personal training and qualified instruction at Performance Fitness at Edwardsville. You could even work out for a full 30 days before making a commitment to join. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness can help you keep your New Year's resolution. Performance Fitness in Edwardsville. PerformanceFitness618.com.
Oh, morning star, oh, morning star, shine from bright above.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the Epiphany season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Epiphany season, 24/7. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Terry Mattingly is our guest, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate. We're talking about media coverage of Roman Catholic and non-Roman Catholic clergy abuse. Terry, talk a little bit about how the media has covered Opus Dei as an organization itself. This is an interesting organization that is different from the kind of your standard fair and regular diocese in that it is populated mostly, almost a vast majority, by lay people.
Opus Dei is known as this kind of secret group, when in reality, I have always found them very easy to talk to and very upfront, especially the lay people. There's a lot of secrecy in the Roman Catholic Church at all. But one of the fascinating things right now, when you look at the McCluskey case versus the McCarrick case, is the McCarrick coverage opened with a bang. But right now, the evidence is that everything that's gone on in the McCarrick case has been held behind closely locked doors at the Vatican and elsewhere, which led to the whole point of my post, which was, you know, are some sins worthy of secrecy more than others in the Catholic Church, in that the McCarrick situation looks more like the normal scandal in Catholicism. You have abuse of young males, abuse that then continues through their teen years, post-pubescent into ephebophilia relationships. And then you have, most strikingly, these rumors that turned out to be true of decades of emotional and physical abuse of seminarians. Well, those are hot-button topics. But once the New York Times had broken that story, the McCarrick process has gone totally behind locked, closed doors. Opus Dei made this scandal involving McCluskey public, apparently when the woman came back to them again and said, during the Me Too era, I think there may be more victims. I want you to make this public. And they did. And not only did they do that, they did so in a very outward and open fashion where they talked very bluntly, even to having their primary spokesman in New York give a blunt interview when he says he thinks they handled it improperly years ago and that that bothered him greatly. And you had this remarkable passage in a Washington Post story where basically Brian Finnerty, the spokesperson, ends up breaking into tears as he describes how bad he thought this was handled. Really, really quite remarkable stuff. Meanwhile, the Washington Post also has a story today, and then they had an even stronger op-ed page piece a couple of days ago talking about that the Vatican is handling the McCarrick case in complete, total secrecy, and that the goal appears to be to get that over with, to get him punished before the big sexual abuse summit, and to prevent public discussions of some of these other aspects of McCarrick's sexual history, shall we say, the ones that involve priests and young men and seminarians, and whether or not there was a network of people who helped protect him. At the end of my post today, this is how I ended it. So what will reporters and thus ordinary Catholics learn about the sins of McCarrick as opposed to the sins of McCluskey? In particular, what will Vatican insiders allow to surface on this critical question linked to McCarrick abuse of seminarians and priests? Who protected McCarrick from investigations of the rumors that surrounded him for decades? And who profited from his favor during that era? Well, you can see that those are questions about the heart of the Roman Catholic network and insiders within the Vatican, because McCarrick was one of the most powerful cardinals in the world and certainly one of the most powerful in the United States. So you start breaking his life out into the open, you're going to drag lots of other people out into the open with him. McCluskey, you can let him go down, you can let Opus Dei take a little bit of the heat, and if anything, you get to say, hey, look, our priests get into trouble messing around with women too, which is true, by the way. But it's helping, I would say, deflect some of the attention away from McCarrick and some of the issues there as well.
Do you think we're going to be even able journalistically to learn the final disposition of Theodore McCarrick?
I think that in the McCarrick case, and then at the Vatican summit, I think we talked about this as recently as last week, I think you're going to see a tremendous influence on strengthening the protection of children from sexual abuse by priests, which actually is the part of the Roman Catholic scandal where they've done the best work already, and they've already made the greatest progress, especially in the last decade or two after the policy that went into effect after a critical meeting in Dallas about a decade and a half ago. They've made huge progress on clergy sexual abuse of children. What about these other issues? I think you're going to see them do everything they can to not talk about McCarrick's relationships with other cardinals, other bishops, the people who kind of came out of the tree of power that he helped create, some of whom are in extremely powerful positions in the Catholic Church, people with long decades of ties to McCarrick, people, frankly, that reporters would say simply had to know what was going on in this man's life, even if they weren't a part of it. So I don't think we're going to get much in public about McCarrick, and I don't think at the clergy sexual abuse summit with the Vatican, I don't think you're going to get discussions of the relationships of priests with teenage boys, with other males, consensual or not, and the seminarian question, and the networks that flow out of the seminaries, the networks of relationships and loyalties and secrecy, and even some would say blackmail. I don't think we're going to see any of that discussed in public. The issue is whether reporters will even go strongly after those questions.
Compare and contrast, if you would, how the coverage of John McCluskey's situation, as parallel as it is, how does it compare with the coverage of, say, Bill Hybels in the last days before he resigned? What were the challenges there that the reporters, in this case, Chicago Tribune and then later the New York Times, face in covering those two very similar cases in terms of what was done, but very dissimilar cases in terms of the churches they're associated with?
Well, in that case, you had Hybels being a national level superstar and someone who was, again, very well known to the press. You also had a very upfront get out there and cover this story process involving the Chicago Tribune and some of the media in Chicago. And don't forget the importance of Christianity Today being based outside of Chicago. And once Christianity Today starts writing about something within evangelicals, a lot of that is going to stir up attention. So the Hybels case took a long time to unfold. He was extremely popular. His connections to people like Bill and Hillary Clinton stood him well. I think he was not a rabble-rousing pro-Trump evangelical. He was a moderate, even slightly left-of-center evangelical. But eventually, that story got covered. The McCluskey story is just now beginning to open up. And what I think is really interesting about it is the degree to which it reflects a decision by the woman to say, I want my story told now. And the story behind the story is Opus Dei and its leadership at this moment in time saying, okay, we were wrong to have handled the McCluskey case as gently as we did a decade or so ago. We will now go public. It's always easy for reporters to cover stories when the people at the heart of the story return your phone calls. You can't show up, knock on the door of the Vatican Embassy in Washington and say, hey, everybody come out and answer our questions. That's not how the Vatican and its institutions work. You can't subpoena the Pope. So to some degree, the McCluskey story was easy to cover once they started talking very openly and upfront about it. Before that, those of us who knew John McCluskey for years, as I did, I didn't know. I knew he had left D.C. I knew he told me that he was being used as a consultant in ministries in a couple of places, that one or two that were pretty logical. He was running support groups for people involved at high levels of the Silicon Valley business community, which when he told me that made sense to me. I didn't know at that time to ask questions about, well, are you continuing to hear confessions by women? You know, other things that were a part of this, of him kind of being slightly silenced and sent into semi-exile after this financial settlement with the woman in D.C. So you could see those are slightly different situations, but it's easy to cover a story when people want to talk about it or are willing to talk about it. It's very hard to cover a story when extremely powerful and secretive groups who do not have to answer your questions decide, no, we're not going to talk about this at all. There are some cardinals in America very, very close to Ted McCarrick that I think that if you tried to ask them a question about this in a press conference right now, they would just duck the question and go right to the next one, and you might not ever be invited to cover those major events in the Catholic Church again.
One thing seems pretty evident, and that is, barring some, I can't imagine what kind of event could top McCarrick. I mean, it's flabbergasting. But it does appear that at least at the moment, both the Vatican and the people involved here in the United States feel themselves immune to social, any kind of social pressure. With about a minute, your thoughts there.
Well, I mean, don't forget the moment when Pope Francis said to journalists on the airplane, when someone did ask about the charges made by Archbishop Vigano, when the Pope said, I'm not going to address that, and I expect all of you to do your jobs and handle this responsibly. That said just about everything you needed to say. If anything was going to happen, journalists were going to make it happen, but they weren't going to get any cooperation from anybody who answered to Pope Francis. And that slammed a door that has made it extremely hard to cover that story ever since. Now, so what could be more spectacular than McCarrick? Well, quite frankly, it would be if anybody managed to prove any of the found documents to prove any of the accusations by Archbishop Vigano. We're back to the question, who protected Ted McCarrick and how high up the Vatican structures did that protection go? That's been the question all along. That's the question that I don't know if anybody's ever going to be able to answer.
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He is author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, talk with you again next week.
Glad to do so.
When we come back, Scott Klusendorf of Life Training Institute will be our guest. We're going to talk about that viral video called Kids Meet Someone Who's Had an Abortion. Stay tuned.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Solway class, today your writing prompt is, what is Lutheran about classical education?
Hey, what does this mean?
I think it's that Aristotle was a Lutheran.
I thought it was that Lutheran classical was a palindrome.
What's a palindrome?
It's like a Persian castle with a retractable roof.
Life is confusing enough without crowdsourcing your questions. Get straight answers at an open house on Lutheran classical education at St. Paul Lutheran School in Hamel, Illinois, on January 13 at 1 o'clock p.m. Pastor Robert Paul of Memorial Lutheran, Houston, Texas, will speak on the question, what is Lutheran about classical education?
Wait, it was Virgil who was a Lutheran.
Come on out to St. Paul Lutheran in Hamel, Illinois on January 13 at 1 o'clock p.m. Learn more at school.stpaulhamel.org.